Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
This is Rachel Roddy. I'm thrilled to be here in conversation with Massimo Montanari about his new book, A Short History of Spaghetti with Tomato Sauce, for the London Review Bookshop. Massimo is a medievalist and currently Professor of Food History at the University of Bologna and one of the world's foremost authorities on early modern eating. He's been a visiting professor at universities all over the world, and he's one of the founders of the International Review of Food and History, and has authored and co-authored 17 books, many of which have been translated. I am a huge fan. His essays provided me with a doorway into his work and are one of the reasons that I began and continue to write about Italian food. Three of his books in particular, including this beautiful new one, A Short History of Spaghetti with Tomato Sauce, never leave my desk. His work has underpinned my work. In fact, when I was doing the gentle research for my recipe book, An A to Z of Pasta, I recommend not only making spaghetti with tomato sauce as often as you can, but seeking out his short history of spaghetti. So Massimo, it is an absolute delight to be in conversation with you today.
Thank you. Thank you, Rachel. For me too, it's a pleasure to be here in conversation with you.
In fact, we're here. So where are you? How are you and where are you?
I am in Italy, but that is obvious. And I am at home in Imola. Imola is a small town, 30 kilometers south of Bologna, where I teach. And I live here. I live here with my wife in a fine house. I feel very good. I feel very good at home.
Lovely. Actually, well, I'm not at home. I'm in London, I was born near London. I'm in Clerkenwell, but usually home is Rome. It's very nice to be in London and very nice to be holding. I've had the proof, but very, very lovely to be holding this new edition of A Short History of Spaghetti with Tomato Sauce, which is a beautiful thing. Europa editions have done a beautiful job. I think it's a lovely structure. And actually, for the conversation, the book gives us a lovely structure. And I thought what we could do was start by talking about the introduction, which is also a warning. Words handle with care. I was trying to think what that is in Italian. Parole, maneggiare con cura. Words handle with care. Could you talk a little bit about this book? Maybe looking at the sort of the idea of origins, because of course the Italian book has a different title.
Yes, the Italian book has a title, The Myth of Origins, and A Short History of Spaghetti with Tomato Sauce in the subtitle, because in this book I try to tell a little story of a very famous dish, but at the same time I'm not making only a history of the gastronomy. It's not only a gastronomic tour. My aim is to get a reflection on the fact that starting from a little story of the gastronomic science, we can reflect on words and concepts we use every day, like origins, like identity, like roots, because these are, as I wrote, words to manage, to handle with care, because there are many misunderstandings, starting from the main misunderstanding, to think the origins like the explanation of what will happen. So my story of spaghetti with tomato sauce that nowadays, today, is a very distinctive dish of Italian culture, is perhaps the most famous dish of Italian gastronomic culture, is not to be intended like something that always was part of Italian culture, but on the contrary, like something that has been the result of many, many encounters, made by different products, different technique, different encounters. So the theme of the identity that is not at the origin of something that does not exist, but now is the result of similar encounters made during the history. I don't know why this title has disappeared from the English version of the book, but I think that everyone who has the book in his hands will understand that it is not only a gastronomic history.
I mean, I like the title in English. I mean, of course, origin, sort of the beginning. I love the first chapter because, of course, as a sort of keen, especially as a as an an English woman writing about Italian food, I was very, very keen to sort of find the beginning, where it all started, and that would explain it. And then, of course, you continue with sort of origins, and there's the sort of myth of origins, of course, those sort of incredible, fantastical, made up ones, because we're reassured by the idea that things sort of happened in a very certain way. And of course, the story of pasta is uncertain, isn't it? I mean, the story is uncertain. It's also opaque at the beginning. In fact, when I was making my jigsaw, I wondered whether pieces were missing. A couple of chapters later, you have an early experience of fake news, don't you? Very topical.
Well, the fake news that I tell in the book is that of Marco Polo, that should have brought spaghetti to Italy, while this is totally invented. Because, yes, China and Italy are perhaps the two parts of the world, a very big one, China, a very short one, a very little one, Italy, where pasta has been important and is important, but they are two separate histories. Marco Polo visited China and he could see in China some kinds of pasta, but he recognized it because in Italy, at that time, they already ate pasta, they knew pasta, they produced pasta. So they are two different, totally different things. In fact, my book, telling a brief history of pasta in Italy, that does not go to China, but to the Middle East, the Persian world, the Arab world. This is the key from which. This is the key for understanding something of pasta history, not China. China doesn't work at all.
Yeah, no, lovely. And in fact, so shall we go backwards? In fact, I had a very sort of probably simple idea in my head when I was writing my book. This idea that, well, sort of in the beginning was a big ball of dough, wasn't there? But that there were sort of two parents, and actually those two traditions, the Greco-Romano and the Arab, and those two pastas. So could you talk, because I think you do that very beautifully. I love those early chapters, the sort of two about the Greco-Romano Lagana and then the Arab Tria, and then how they converged. So could you talk a bit about those now?
Yes, a Greek-Roman tradition of pasta does exist, but not very important. It exists, but in ancient Roman cuisine, pasta was simply an ingredient to thicken soups or to add, but it was not a real kind of food as today. And it was always fresh pasta. The second parent, as you call it, is the Middle East, is the Greek Persian tradition that comes to Europe through the Arabs that in the early Middle Ages conquer many parts of the Mediterranean world, including Sicily. And Sicily is perhaps the place, the most critical, the most important place to understand this mixture of cultures, of influences that mix together, that act together, because Sicily, since the ancient times, had been the region of the most, the biggest production of wheat, and it was really the granary of Roman Empire, and the tradition of pasta had been important in Sicily. But when Sicily in the early Middle Ages was invaded by the Arabs, it came in contact with the second important pasta tradition, that of dry pasta. And this is very important, is crucial for the history of gastronomic Italy, because we were talking about China before, but in China tradition, even today, pasta is always fresh. Italy is the only place in the world where the industry of pasta, dry pasta, because industry means commercializing, means making a big amount, not only for personal or family use, but for selling, for traveling. And this was the crucial apport of the Arab culture in a Sicily that already had a pasta tradition, came from the Greek Roman world. And from Sicily, this new culture of pasta became a kind. We talk, when you open cookbook, an Italian cookbook today, you have a big chapter on pasta. Pasta is a kind, un genere. How a kind is okay, a kind. And this happens only starting from the Middle Ages. Pasta becomes a kind in itself, not an ingredient, but a kind of food in itself. And starting from Sicily, it spreads all over Italy. And in a few centuries, we find pasta industries in many Italian regions, mostly on coastal area, on sea areas. And this not only for climate reasons, because with the climate of sea, pasta dries better, but because sea is the place for exporting pasta, for traveling, for selling. So this is the real novelty of the Middle Ages in the history of pasta. And spaghetti is of the protagonist of this story.
Yeah, absolutely. And that sort of idea of encounters and movement. Actually, we drove, thanks to you, we went to, am I saying it right, Trabia, in Sicily. Yeah, where the mills were seen, that wonderful sort of lyrical passage, wasn't it? He was a geographer, an Arab geographer, who wrote that wonderful description of mills.
Yes.
And then the sort of movement as well, I suppose, to sort of Naples and then up to Genova. It's a very physical feeling. And I think your ideas of movement and encounter sort of come up again and again in this book. And I love that. It's a sense of meeting and movement. And then you've talked about the fact that we're moving from fresh pasta to dried pasta. And then, of course, in this converging, and I suppose the next big convergence or arrival that we could talk about is the tomato. So we're in Naples. Should we jump to tomato? Am I being premature here? We can always.
The tomato is a new encounter that happens in the modern era, because it's an American product brought to Europe only in the 16th century. And for a long time, tomato was not accepted in cuisine, European cuisine. Only by the 18th, 19th centuries, tomato became important in Italian cuisine, but only with the shape of a sauce, not in itself, but as a sauce, and became to be adopted for seasoning pasta. What they had made for centuries, since the Middle Ages on, pasta was seasoned only with white products. The main was cheese. Parmesan
yes.
cheese was the might of the Middle Ages when Giovanni Boccaccio imagines the land of cocaine. In this marvelous place, there is a mountain of cheese, of Parmesan cheese, over which there is a big chaudron, una grande caldaia, una grande pentola.
A great big pan, yes, a big sort of cauldron or pan.
Cooking pasta that then come down over the mountain and get cheesed.
Yeah.
This is a word I am inventing now. This is cheese.
I think it's a wonderful word.
and at the end of this mountain, there is a lake of butter. So butter, cheese, for people not who could not afford butter because it was a precious product, lard, the fat of the pork. Anyway, this combination, this mixture, this meeting of pasta and cheese was for century the winning choice. Something changes only in modern times, very near to us, between the between the 18th and the 19th centuries. Something new is tested on pasta. One of these is tomato sauce that is added to cheese. Cheese does not disappear, never.
No, in fact, the cheese is there. And in fact, somebody has asked a question about the Arab pasta tradition of flour and water. And actually, it seems a perfect opportunity to go back a bit. I'm sorry, I did jump. We're in Sicily. The Arabs are drying strings, aren't they? Strings of pasta, I assume.
Long shape yeah. of pasta.
So we have long strings that are then being transported by sea. And I suppose maybe we should go back and talk a bit about the sort of evolution of shapes. So there continue to be strings, which were known as, they had various names. Tria.
Tria is the Arab name, but it is also the Greek name. So there is a coincidence between the Greek and the Arab name, tria, that is a name still today existing in Italian language for some kinds of pasta. It means both dry pasta in general and dry pasta of long and thin shape.
Then the tria would become vermicelli in Naples?
Yes, vermicelli, tagliatelli. The word spaghetti is very recent. It appears only in the 19th century. But already in medieval cookbooks, we find some expressions that open the road to spaghetti, to the word spaghetti. When they write that these types of pasta should be of the same shape of a spago. Spago is what we use in shoes.
Yes, strings. Or
labels. Yes. So in the beginning, it is the way to explain to the readers of the cookbooks how this shape should it be. And then with passing the centuries, it become a word for indicating the spaghetti. But in Naples, because Naples was in modern centuries, not since the beginning, but since the 17th century on, in Naples, Till today, they don't use the name spaghetti for telling spaghetti. They use the term macaroni.
Yeah.
Macaroni, for us, in the perfect theoretical Italian language, macaroni is a short pasta. But in Naples, macaroni are spaghetti.
Yeah, actually, that the macaroni was maybe the word that gave me more trouble than
yes.
all of them. I mean, I felt
this is normal. It gives trouble to us. Oh.
I would wrestle, and I remember I was given a sort of recipe book with recipes from ancient to modern, and throughout it, macaroni seems to mean every single shape, you know, possible. So yeah, that was a, and I mean, the origins of macaroni as a word are quite misty, aren't they?
Yes, there are many interpretations. Some of them are a little bit fantasy interpretations, but I think that macco is maccare. Maccare is a word that we find in ancient and medieval language for pestare. How do you say pestare?
To crush or pound. To pound or crush.
To pound and making something that the shape of un impasto, no?
Ammaccare was to sort of form.
Yes, ammaccare. In Italian, we have this word today, ammaccare. When you go with your car, something that is pestato, crushed. What is funny is that this word macaroni is both the whole word of pasta and a single shape of pasta. How did you manage to choose some in your book on pasta to choose some and not other kinds of pasta, some shapes? Because in Italy there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds name and shapes of pasta.
But I have to say, I read you and other people, but I have to say, once I started looking at the sort of story through your eyes particularly, it did become clear what needed to be there. So it was interesting that actually, while I did leave shapes out, and I live in Rome, so there was a tendency to be sort of quite Romana. My partner is Sicilian, so I have that, obviously, rigatoni. But it was interesting how writing is as much about what you leave out as what you put in.
Yes.
So actually,
oh, yes.
So it was an interesting, but it was interesting. And I have to say, it was around macaroni and gnocchi and ravioli that I really felt like I was wrestling physically with the history of Italy. But at the same time, you know, like you say something wonderful about pasta, such a little word for such a big universe. And this sort of idea that it is singular, but delineated in hundreds of forms. And writing was a bit like that. It was simple and incredibly complicated at the same time.
I like very much this story of pasta that gets many, many shapes. Because if I think not to the situation of today, when each shape is combined with a special sort of sauce. But if I think to my Middle Ages or the early modern times, when pasta was always seasoned with cheese and butter or lard, I think that the reason why Italian people invented so many shapes for pasta is that shape is important for eating, not only the substance, but only the but even the shape. Each shape in itself, not for being seasoned in some way or another way, but in itself, the shape gives some sensation to your mouth. It's a question of touch. From this point of view, I always remember a singular recipe that was invented by Gualtiero Marchesi, the most renowned Italian chef of last century, of proposing four different shapes of pasta, seasoned all four in the same identical way, and white, in this case he preferred olive oil. And this experiment was proposed just to make people understand that a different shape gives a different taste. I find it genial also from, if you want, a philosophical point of view, because it means that there is no so much difference between substance and shape. Shape is also substance in some way.
No, absolutely. I love your essay about sort of that form and flavour. And I always think of the sort of difference between a sort of ribbon of tagliatelle and a quill of penne. These very, absolutely, these completely different sort of feelings and sensations, and therefore, you know, form giving way to sort of taste. It's fascinating. And then also, I mean, I have to remind myself often when I am writing that I am looking at a modern Italian map. And Vincenzo always reminds me to get the older, that, you know, the regions are so recent and the divisions are so recent and that it was so different. So, of course, when I'm looking at regional recipes, to remember that Italy was divided in very different ways, and you see this huge regionality and understand the huge differences between the north and the south and the middle. The south being ruled by the two Sicilies, is that right?
Yes. Naples and the south, Naples, the Sicilies. Sicily was the first region when this story began. Then, some centuries later, Naples was the place for another step in the history of pasta. Because at Naples, for the first time, spaghetti, macaroni, as we said, the word that we can choose what to use, for the first time became a staple food for poor people in the cities and later in the country, because in the Middle Ages pasta was much used and appreciated, both on court, on the rich levels, haute cuisine, and in the lower classes, but it was not the staple food for anyone. It was a food, an important food, much more and more important with passing the time, but only in the 17th century and starting from Naples, it became an actual staple food, as it remains still today. Mm-hmm. And this is another important passage that I noticed in my book, because in the previous situation, Middle Ages, Renaissance, mainly on upper class uses, but generally speaking, pasta was often used as a side dish for meat. This is another curious question to understand. This is true today, but not in Italy. Outside, yeah. Abroad, I think in England too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in France and in Germany, in other countries, pasta still keeps this identity of side dish of something, while in Italy this disappears in the last two centuries.
And also very different cooking times.
Yes, because when pasta was proposed as a side dish for meat or other dishes, it was cooked for a long time. Italians today use the word scotta,
Overcooked.
Overcooked. In Italy, when pasta become a staple food, that is the most important thing you have in your plate, the cooking methods begin to prefer the al dente cooking. Al dente is an Italian expression that cannot be translated. Al dente means that you cook pasta for several minutes, but it must retain his la sua durezza, la sua.
Yeah, it's power. Yeah, I struggled translating this. I mean, we translate it generally to sort of to the tooth, but it's a descriptor, isn't it? It's a descriptor of how the pasta should feel, which is strong and a little bit resistant. But again, this was something I've jumped us back and forward with tomatoes, but of course you have this lovely progression and we see these elements of different cooking, the introduction of the fork, we see the evolution, we see the cheese, the different fats. And then of course we see the different histories between the North and the South. Because of course, you know, while dried pasta is being extruded in the South, more or less, in the North, we have a whole different world of wealth and fresh and filled pasta. That was a galaxy that I was quite terrified by, actually, the sort of filled pasta galaxy. And Bologna felt like a terrifying place.
I should say that having today the spaghetti or the spaghetti al pomodoro, spaghetti tomato sauce as the Italian dish for excellence means that the Southern gastronomic model wins, has won, ha vinto. I think that Italian cuisine is very rich, is very differentiated among the regions and provinces and countries and cities. And the South and the North are not the same thing, but there are things that come from Southern experience, historical experience, that became some identifying dishes of our gastronomy. Pasta is just this. What you said is true, because we never think abbastanza, so much.
Enough.
At the difference between fresh pasta and dry pasta.
Mm-hmm.
Dry pasta is historically typical of the South of our country, while fresh pasta remains typical of the North. But this is the result of different products, because for making dry pasta we should have durum wheat, grano duro.
Absolutely, with hard wheat, grano,
hard wheat.
Absolutely.
Grows well in the South of Italy, but not in the North.
Got it.
That's the reason why we have so a difference between Naples and the South that improve the tradition of dry pasta in Italy, and the North that remains linked to some typical family dishes based on fresh pasta. But it's a world.
It's wonderful, and actually,
it's a very complicated world.
Yeah, but I have to say, what in the cooking pasta chapter, you allow yourself a personal anecdote, but I wanted to also, you know, go back to another anecdote, which is you have about meatballs and the sort of philosophizing in the kitchen and the sort of practical act of cooking, which is sort of where the learning starts. And I feel, even though your work is a way scholarly, but I feel all the time that we are in the kitchen with you. And of course, as a recipe writer, that is very, it's very reassuring for me, because it is complicated, but actually at the same time, you know, to understand making tagliatelle and lasagna, I was baffled. But then, of course, I remembered that I could go and make it. So it's this sort of constant movement is an element of your work I like very much about, and the things we learn in the kitchen, you return often, who was she, Sister Juana? But, you know, the sort of idea of what we do learn in the kitchen, what we, the act of cooking, and that's where it sort of starts. Am I right in saying that?
I'm very affectionate to Sor Juana. She was a Mexican, but this, how do you say, the chef of an abbey?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose an abbey cook. I think you describe her in the English edition. You describe her as, I think you describe her, yes, as a, well, a poet.
Yes, but, yes. She was an intellectual woman. She was a poet. She was a writer. And she was the abbess of a monastery in Mexico City. We are not no more in Italy. We are no more in the Middle Ages. We are in the 17th century. She loved very much to have meetings with intellectuals, with writers, with philosophers. And in her monastery, she had constructed something that really looked like a modern bookshop, for example, where people encounters and she was rimproverata. How do you say rimproverata? She was
told off, maybe. She was
from the archbishop.
She was told off, yeah.
Yes. Reprimanded. And he told her she should not go in this themes of literature, of poetry, of philosophy, because she was a woman and her job was cooking. And she could not disobey this order, but she wrote a cookery book with an introductory letter, with an introduction, where she explained that making cuisine, cooking, is not only making dishes and managing eggs or this or oil or butter or every products you want, but that doing that is a very difficult thing, is a very difficult occupation that lets you understand how the world, the nature works. So she concluded saying that you can cook and make philosophy at the same time, because cooking is also thinking. I like very much this anecdote because it links the practice of cooking with the practice of thinking. And the complication of stories like the story of pasta that we are dealing with today shows us that cooking or preparing a shape or another shape of pasta is a very complicated thing that means to think, not only to make what other people learn you to make. That means thinking. And this is true not only for the Greek chefs of restaurants that make ricette d'autore, recipes that are...
Like signature dishes.
Signature, yes. But also for popular recipes. And when we deal with the story of pasta, we are always in face of a popular culture, of recipes that are not fixed in a place where someone decided what to do in which way, but something that is produced by an amount of people, generation from generation, to adjust, to combine, to encounter a new.
I find your work very liberating in that sense. In all your work, there's a sort of repeated theme about this. Actually, it comes back to the idea of recipes and what that means. I think you go back to the Latin, a bit of this and a bit of that and what I need. And you talk a lot about the sort of the evolving and the encounters and not freezing things, not putting them in museums. And actually, that was my sort of last question to you. I mean, not so much a question as an idea that, you know, as a food writer, especially a foreigner, I'm very aware of being true to Italian recipes. But in fact, you yourself have that great line about, you know, that terrible word true, like deeming everything else false, and the idea that things are always changing. And I have this great sense in your work that, you know, that things can exist at the same time, that, you know, we can look at historical recipes and value them, and at the same time, things are always evolving. I found that idea in your work and continue to find it very liberating.
Yes, if we compare a recipe of today with a recipe of the Middle Ages, eventually with the same name both, but the taste is different, the ingredients are different, and even if I compare spaghetti al pomodoro, spaghetti mm-hmm. with tomato sauce of today, with the first recipes that I find, spaghetti with tomato sauce, in the cookery books of the first half of the 19th century. So,
yeah,
for a medievalist, medievalist is yesterday.
In fact, yeah.
I find an amount of differences, starting with the fact, for example, that olive oil was not used at the time, but only butter or lard. Think of that the first recipe, the first Italian recipe described in a cookbook in the 30s of the 19th century is mm-hmm. seasoned with lard. Today, olive oil seems to be the unique possible, the only possible fat for seasoning pasta with tomato. And then all what tomato sauce has brought with it.
Mm-hmm.
We find the garlic,
yeah.
onion, chili, basil. I tried in this book to deconstruct the recipe, one recipe of the tomato with tomato sauce and spaghetti. And most of the ingredients that are usual today were not present before tomato, because when the condiment was cheese, is non è adatto,
not adapted, not adaptable, not fitting,
it doesn't work with chili or with onion. So what I say, but you said better than me, is that recipes are never fixed, are not frozen, and from time to time we can see how they evolve with the taste in a great freedom. I always like to repeat that cooking is the word of freedom, not of rules. Of course, we need rules, because it's not a total anarchy, but inside these rules we are really free.
Oh yeah. I mean, I love that. And in fact, that again, in writing recipes, gave me great freedom. You know, the idea that you can, and also home cooking, you know, by its very nature, quite anarchic. We can be, at least we can be anarchists in the kitchen, while at the same time, I repeat that again and again, but I love that sort of balance in your work, that the sort of the two things can exist at once and alongside the idea of these encounters, because again and again in your book, we are all over the globe. You know, we are moving and we are meeting, and you have some lovely, I think the first chapter, the opening, words handle with care, is wonderful. The sort of enriching by the encounters. I'm aware we should probably, there's some questions. Oh, so Heather was asking about why was dried pasta needed in Italy? So she supposed it replaced earlier staples, such as sort of earlier preparations. Why was dried pasta needed in Italy? As a transportable food, as something to be transported, maybe?
Not only to be transported, but to be preserved for a lot of time.
Of course.
You can preserve dry pasta. And in the history of food, in the history of cuisine and gastronomy, this topic of the preservation of food has been always a very, very central, very important, the most important. If you think which are the most popular foods in history, I would say cheeses, mm-hmm. and salumi. How do you say salumi?
Like salami, cured meat. We use your word.
Why cured meat? Because meat it cannot be preserved for a long time. Cured meat, yes. You can have it in your house for months, for years sometimes. And why cheese? Because cheese is the only way historically found to preserve milk.
Yeah, of course.
For us today, it's easy to use milk. We have the frigo, we have the freezer, no? But if you are a man of the ancient times, of medieval time, of early modern times, still 2 centuries ago, you have a lot of milk. What you do with this milk? You invent cheese. This why I am saying this, because I think that the possibility of dried pasta to be preserved for a long time has been one of the most important element of its success as a staple food.
And then, which is why it became, and then transported all over the world. I was just going to say, somebody was asking a question about Lucy in Hungary, about a pasta dish of tagliatelle style pasta with pork cracklings, pork lardo croccante, fresh cheese and sour cream. She was saying it sounds a bit like a medieval pasta dish.
Why not? It sounds medieval, mainly, I would say, for the sour cream, because the sour taste was always present in medieval taste. Medieval taste was always trying to have all tastes together in each dish. So a little bit sweet, but a little bit acid, sour. All the times we find something sour, sweet, sour, salted. Where the tastes are mixed, we are in face of an ancient taste.
Yes,
perhaps sometimes today modern contemporary taste has been oriented to more defined tastes. If you think, for example, of modern Italian cuisine, we love very much, we have today the myth of products. A product must be itself. A tomato must taste a tomato. A zucchini must taste zucchini. This meat must taste itself. This was not the taste of some centuries ago, when they tried to mix together different tastes. So the presence of sour cream is very, very medieval. I read once a very interesting letter of an immigrant in Italy. He came from the Eastern Europe, and he was saying that he loved very much Italian cuisine. He loved very much spaghetti. He loved spaghetti carbonara, but he found them a little bit lacking of sour. So he added sour cream. This is a medieval memory to have an historian that makes an historian reading of the recipe.
Wonderful. I thought, and actually, I'm thinking it's these ideas, once everyone's read this book, then they will go off and read all your other books, because you explore this again and again, the sort of sweet and salty. Oh, somebody was asking about the is the culture of pasta making in Italy in decline? What do
Is
you think?
not in decline. It seems to be in decline, but it's not. Because apart that many people still do it, we have changed the way to do it, because we have now many, many shops where people do pasta, fresh pasta. Perhaps
Exactly.
it is in decline in house cooking, but not in house eating, because we can find it out of home, out of house. And it is very, very interesting, this factor. Perhaps there is not as in the past the same capacity in all houses to make pasta. This is true. But there is people that make it for us. For example, for reasons of time, we are all working and on. But if you want tagliatelle, I go in the front of my house and they sell it. And I can compare this tagliatelle with the tagliatelle that I bought a little in another place. I don't know if the living in a small town like Imola helps this possibility of finding fresh pasta everywhere, but I see that even in Bologna is just the same. And I don't know. I am li a little bit optimistic,
I think I am too, I think.
and I see also the fact that the courses of baking pasta are more and more popular in Italy, and young people want to go to learn how to make pasta. I think we had some decades ago, perhaps in the 70s, in the 80s, this decline. But now we are going up again.
Our hour is up, so I think that's a perfect note of like absolute optimism for sort of the continued story of spaghetti with tomato sauce. That was a real delight talking to you. Thank you so much. I feel it's a wonderful book. I mean, I want everyone to go and read it and hold it. It's like it's very complete, but it's also like doors being opened, which is what I love about it. Yes, complete, and at the same time, doors will be opened for everybody.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.